The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
And when you realize finally that, again, this embryo is a life, why am I in charge of this? And why, again, I felt like we were starting to treat embryos as a commodity. I felt just not wanting to be involved in it. And so as a result, for me, it was my conscience, and it was the Holy Spirit telling me really to examine my life, what I was doing, and what my goal was ultimately, and where my ultimate, you know, where I wanted to be, both in this life and the next.
It's the Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, that was former IVF practitioner Dr. Lauren Rubel telling Lila Rose about how the Holy Spirit awakened her conscience at the moral dilemmas within the medical practice of in vitro fertilization. Good afternoon. It's good to be with you. I'm Drew Mariani. I thought, I was hesitant initially about doing this because I've kind of touched on this a few times already, but after watching the State of the Union address with the president, he mentioned IVF. When I saw the rebuttal from the Republican side, the Alabama senator, talk about IVF, when I've seen legislation being passed and Supreme Court decisions on IVF, I thought we should talk about it. Do you understand the moral implications of in vitro fertilization? True story, I have a friend. He is a very successful man. He made a lot of money and married a girl about 16 years younger than him. And she went on to med school, and he paid for the med school. She ended up, you know, spending all that time doing her education, then her residency, and finally got out and wanted to have a child. But he was up there in age now. He was an older man, like I said, 16 years older. And as a result, they couldn't have a child. So she's a physician, right, a surgeon, and she said, well, let's do in vitro fertilization. And he's a good Catholic. He would not do the in vitro. And as a result of it, she ended up running around on him. She cheated on him. He found the receipt to the hotel room that she was with, and their marriage ended up in divorce. He was heartbroken. He loved her. He communicated to her that let's adopt, let's have a child. We don't need to do in vitro. And I thought, you know, we hear so much about it. I know you might have a child from in vitro. You might be thinking about doing in vitro. And there's a lot of love that comes. And we, you know, of course, you love your child. I'm not in any way here to diminish that. But I want to talk about the morality of this. So you better understand, as this becomes an issue that both sides of the aisle right now you hear talking about. Right? This is a life issue. And I'll bring it back in time first. We'll go back to 1978 when Louise Brown was born in England. She was the first child to be brought to birth after being conceived by in vitro fertilization. It was a major story. It lasted in the press and the media for weeks on end. And the moral implications of this method, they really still are very profound. You know, you saw it play out in 1992 in Tennessee in a divorce case where the disposition of embryos that were in, you know, cryogenic preservation, we're at the issue of the French Catholic geneticist, Dr. Jerome Lejeune, who was called to testify as an expert witness. Unfortunately, his testimony in favor of preserving the lives of the frozen children, it fell on deaf ears. IVF then fell under the radar of the Alabama case, where the state Supreme Court ruled that destroying frozen embryos does violate the state's law against wrongful death of a minor. We talked about that a couple weeks ago, where somebody knocked over a tray of these embryos, they had to be discarded, and they got sued as a result of it. So brought this back onto the spotlight once again. So many women have undergone IVF. And I know there's a longing to be a mom, to be a mother. Because of a couple IVF clinics in Alabama, they shut themselves down after, you know, fearing for liability consequences. There was such an uproar, such a demand for in vitro fertilization and other fertility technologies that they had to be protected. So what happened? We saw legislation passed. Republicans especially felt the heat in the Alabama state, and a state bill was passed very quickly. And now a bill's been introduced in Congress by Florida Republican Ana Paulina Luna that's called the Right to Try IVF 2024. And according to the press release that I saw, and I just saw this the other day or today, the bill states that they can't prevent doctors from performing in vitro fertilization on women who've been certified as experiencing a medical hardship and conceiving a child. So let's talk about it today. I'm joined this afternoon by Dr. Pia De Seleni. She serves as Senior Director of Corporate Engagement for IWP Capital. You can find her online. She's a moral theologian, an ethicist, a cultural analyst. She's been with us many times. Her writing can be found at moraltheologian.com. And I thought this would be such a good issue to dive into today to help better understand it. And by the way, if you want to join us, maybe you're confused or concerned, or you want to know how to talk to somebody you love about this, here's your direct line. 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. Feel free to join our conversation. Doctor, thank you for your time. Welcome back.
Oh, it's great to be back, Drew. Thank you for having me.
Boy, you know, I'd love to do kind of a 101 class on the church teaching on IVF. So, you know, maybe you can bring us through the process, what the church finds morally objectionable. We could go all the way back to Humanae Vitae, which it seems like a strange place to start, but it deals with contraception, and that's a very important principle that's articulated in that encyclical about being unitive and procreative, those aspects of the marital act. But let me throw it to you. You just take us through IVF, what the church teaches, and what's morally problematic and what isn't.
Sure. So the issue is with IVF is that the procreative part of sex is taken out of sex, and it's done in a laboratory. And so the eggs are harvested from the woman, which, by the way, is not a great experience for most women. They're put on ovarian hyperstimulation drugs. One of them is Lupron, which is very, very dangerous to women. And you can look this up online. Anyway, it's not a great experience. They use hormones and drugs to trick the body to produce lots of eggs at one time rather than the regular one or possibly two or in the rare case, three. But so a woman may have 10, 15, 20 eggs harvested. And so it's a several week process of, you know, injecting herself with hormones and drugs to get to the point where her body can generate this many eggs at one time. And then the eggs are generated, that harvested, and then literally like mixed in a petri dish with the sperm. Now, let's say the sperm is so weak that it cannot even penetrate the egg. Then what they do is they actually, it's a process called ICSI, I-C-S-I, and what they actually do is penetrate the egg so that the sperm can enter. So there's a lot of areas that we could go here, but just understand that we're talking about embryos being created that nature would have never created herself, right? If the sperm can't pierce the egg, that child would have never been created in nature, by nature. So the problem is that this is all done outside of the conjugal act, right? It's done in the laboratory. So that's problematic on that level. Then we add a second level, which is now we have diagnostics where we can tell, is this a male embryo? Is this a female embryo? What type of DNA does this embryo have? We can test it for propensities for certain disease, certain characteristics, certain traits. So really now we're looking at a form of eugenicism. And this is the Bishop of Wheeling, West Virginia, just wrote a pastoral letter on this, and he calls it a type of eugenics. I mean, and you could even be, for example, I'm terribly nearsighted, right? You could actually say, I don't want a child that's nearsighted, so we're going to destroy that one, and we're not going to implant it. Let me add another layer of complexity here. In the United States, IVF is largely unregulated. So what doctors will do, fertility specialists will implant as many lots of embryos in a woman, let's say 6, 8. Remember the Octomom from a few years ago? They'll implant as many embryos as they can in hopes that one, maybe two, will actually implant to the uterus and develop into a healthy fetus. Well, then what happens is that sometimes you've got more fetuses than you want, right? So then comes into play this other element, which is called a pregnancy reduction, which is just a nice word for abortion. So now we're bringing abortion in to solve part of the problem because now there are too many babies in the womb. And there, too, there's a type of eugenics that plays out because they can do diagnostics. Now, there are documented cases where, let's say, one fetus was diagnosed as having Down syndrome, but they actually aborted the wrong fetus. So there are a lot of different complexities here. I'm going to add one more piece to the story, and that is, again, this is largely unregulated in the United States, meaning that the impact on women is not well followed and not well understood, not something that's discussed, just on our physical bodies. Take into account, too, you can look up the statistics, the number of couples that split up after doing IVF is huge because it puts such a tremendous stress on the relationship. Then let's add to the fact that, again, in the United States, you can create as many embryos as you want. So we actually have over 1 million frozen embryos. They're excess embryos. They're frozen, sitting in storage. And many of them, and here we come to another complicated moral issue. You can't baptize them because that would kill them, right?
Right.
So Donum Vitae, it's a document from the CDF, I believe 1987, but don't quote me because I'm not sitting in front of my computer.
Okay.
But in there, it talks about these embryos being created for an absurd fate. What do you do with them, right? So the church hasn't opened the door for embryo adoption. It also hasn't closed that door. That's kind of a separate conversation. But the point is that now we have over 1 million frozen embryos in this country alone. Now, other countries, particularly Europe, has, I would say European countries, for example, Germany, I mean, they have a history of battling with eugenics and all sorts of crazy medical experiments, right? They're much more attuned to these sensibilities. So they hardly have any frozen embryos. You can only create as many embryos as you intend to implant at the woman in one treatment. So it's a problematic medical procedure. Mm-hmm. It's risky. It's very, very expensive. The success rate is pretty low. If I'm not mistaken, I think it's lower than 30%. It might be lower, closer to 20%. Meanwhile, here's what's really interesting. And this, again, I just love unpacking the wisdom of the church. And sometimes the church herself doesn't understand her wisdom at the time. But Let's unpack this. So the church has said no to IVF because it takes the procreation part of life out of the conjugal embrace. Here's the thing. NAPRO Technologies, if I'm not mistaken, I think they have a higher than 60% success rate. Because what they're saying is, infertility is pointing to something being off in the bodies of one or both of the spouses, right? So fertility is a healthy state. That is what a healthy body does between, you know, for women, it's, you know, up until they're in their 50s. That's a healthy state of the body, is to be fertile. Infertility is not healthy. I mean, and when I say, I guess I'm qualifying everything here, so forgive me, but I mean, obviously women have a fertile period. That is a normal, healthy thing, right? And that is what a healthy body should be. And instead, going back to contraception, we're saying that a healthy body is one that is infertile. And this is what is fed into the mindset of IVF. And so what NAPRO Technologies does, particularly with regard to the woman, if it's the woman that's struggling with infertility, it's to get her body healthy, right? And when they get her body healthy, guess what?
Yeah.
Conceptions, I think it's, and again, I think the number is higher than 60%.
Wow.
It's something that's worth double checking. So it costs a lot less. The whole scope here is to help a woman be healthy, and it results in healthy pregnancies.
Wow.
Whereas IVF costs a fortune. Some cases it's $25,000 a month, $50,000 for a round. I mean, the prices are all over. Again, unregulated. The impact on the woman's body is harmful. Impact on the relationship is not good often. And then we are creating a million spare embryos. We sometimes implant more embryos than should be in a healthy uterus. And so then we create a need for abortion, which is euphemistically called reduction.
Mm-hmm.
So there's just so many complex things here. And then again, there is that element of eugenics, because you can actually pick which one do I want? What are the traits that I want that child to have? And I'll go back to, you know, you shared the story of your friend. I had a friend who was, she and her husband were struggling with infertility, and she was very much in favor of adoption. And he just went, no, I've got to, you know, we're not, if they're not mine, we're not having them. And she, I loved her perspective. She said, I don't care whose child it is.
Yeah, right.
All I care, I don't care how smart they are. Yeah. I don't care this, that, and you know, she listed off all these qualifications. She said, all I care is that they're good, that they grow up to be saints. And in the end, she and her husband were able to have two children. They didn't adopt, but I loved her perspective. And she said, neither you and I, we can't guarantee that a biological child of ours is going to be a saint.
That's right.
It's going to be a good person. You know, I mean, it's a crapshoot. Sorry to be so blunt.
Oh, it's really true. I've got friends who adopted two children, and my gosh, they look nothing like the parents of Poitou. They love those children, and they are a beautiful family. My oldest son and daughter-in-law, they just adopted a beautiful little baby, too. I wish people would be more open to adoption. You know, fertility is a tough thing, and I think we're seeing a rise in it, too. I don't know what's causing it. I've did a show a little bit on these estrogen mimickers and contraceptives in the water, and there's all sorts of stuff that's happening because we're seeing more and more people struggle with fertility today. I don't know whether you've done any research on that or you could even speak to that. Are you seeing numbers where infertility is now on the rise? Therefore, people are looking towards these alternative methods. And in some respects, maybe it's because women are on contraceptives so long and they want to play God and say, okay, now it's time to have my child. I'm going to come off it. Like my friend who's, I'm sure, you know, wife was in med school and didn't want to have any kids. And now she's ready and suddenly you can't have them. So, would you see a connection there between any of those things?
So I have read literature that does make a connection. Obviously, I'm not expert enough in that area to make the connection, but I've read literature. It makes sense to me because particularly with hormonal contraception, you're training a woman's body to not be receptive to an embryo,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Every month, her body is trained to become a hostile environment for an embryo. So it's kind of like, well, if you train the body to do this, and now suddenly you say, well, I'm not going to do hormonal contraception. Well, the body still has a memory, and we're learning this on so many levels. I mean, with regards to trauma, all sorts of different things. The body has a very real memory, which we're just beginning to understand.
So
it would make sense to me that if a woman's been on hormonal contraception for a long time, and by the way, I mean, I know so many people, they did that because they thought it was, quote unquote, the responsible thing to do. Somebody in their life told them that's what you're supposed to do, right? Someone that they loved and respected.
Yep.
And so people were trying to do, quote unquote, the right thing. Well, then a lot of people do have difficulty conceiving. Some people don't, but a lot of people do. And I also spoke years ago, I spoke with a nurse who did these surgeries, and she said what was fascinating too is a lot of times they do the surgeries and they get in and realize that there's all sorts of scar tissue from chlamydia or some other sexually transmitted disease that hadn't been detected or diagnosed. And so again, are we really trying to get a woman, particularly a woman, and obviously there are cases of male infertility right now,
right,
just focusing
right.
on women. Are we really trying to get women to a point of physical health? And I don't think that's the trajectory that we're on.
That's a good point.
And it's both with contraception. We're saying that what's healthy is an infertile body rather than a fertile body. And the natural state of a woman, you know, while she's menstruating is to have a fertile period. That's what's healthy.
Such an important conversation. My guest today is Dr. Pia DeSeleni. And we've been hearing so much about in vitro fertilization. It can be very confusing. It's not black and white like abortion, right? Yet there are some real morally problematic issues with the process. And we're just talking a little bit about that so you can be better informed when you hear somebody, you know, decide to go down this path or you hear these politicians passing laws. I want you to be in the know. I want you to always, you know, make sure that you are on the right side of the moral issue. If you want to join us, you can dial in right now too. Feel free to ask your question, maybe share your experience. If you had a child this way already, I don't want you to feel guilty. You know, it is a beautiful life and Love that child, of course. I know you do. The number 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. You can call now and get in. And Maggie, I know you wanted to jump in.
Well, I was listening to Pia talk about how the body has a memory. And maybe I'm just posing this question. It's probably too early for us to understand this or see the effects of this. But, you know, I geeked out a while on learning everything I could about epigenetics. And I'm wondering, I wonder if fiddling with people's fertility this way, you know, as she's explaining this complicated, convoluted process that involves all these hormones and drugs and procedures, and will that have an effect then on the next generations, these babies that are born from
So what are epigenetics?
Epigenetics, we used to think that genes were cut in stone, that you could never change your genes.
Right.
But more recently, in the last couple decades, we found out that each gene has sort of an on-off switch.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That depending on your behavior or your experience or sort of the environment that you're in throughout your life, it will turn on or off certain aspects of your genome.
Wow.
And so like they say that even like those who have alcoholics in their family,
yep,
they used to say, well, you know, it's kind of in your genes. You probably will have some like issue with it. That's not the case.
Right.
You can turn on or off these behavioral genes, expressions of genes.
Fascinating. Doctor, why don't you pick up on what Maggie was sharing?
I think it's really interesting. And again, along with this being largely unregulated in the United States, there is very little data that is being tracked. So this would be a really interesting thing to follow. What are the outcomes and indicators of children that are conceived through IVF? What are their fertility issues? What other health indicators are there? It's largely not being tracked. Now, I have come across testimonials of people who were conceived through IVF, no fertility issues at all. All right. So I don't want to create something that's not there.
Right.
My point is that we're not tracking the data to start with. So all we're going to be left with really is anecdotal evidence, and that's based on how much people want to share.
Yeah.
But I think you raise a really good point.
It's fascinating
because we don't know what's being passed on, what's not being passed on.
Right.
And yeah, it's fascinating.
Let me do this. We'll go to the phones. We'll grab a couple calls. 888-914-9149. Stan's in Northern Nevada. Stan, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Drew. I opened up the Catholic Register the other night just thinking about this, and I started reading it and then following these articles, these links. And I start reading about a doctor who substituted his own, you know, sperm to father 100 people and these 100 kids. And then these kids, all of a sudden, they're dating somebody that's actually their brother. They're finding out through this. And then I'm finding out, I'm looking at this and I'm thinking, this is like high-tech rape. It can be almost like high-tech incense. And then I think about what I'm reading about is, now they're bringing people south of the border, taking sperm, doing everything else. And it's not much different than when you had slavery, where you're bringing people over, you own their wife, you own their kids, you could do whatever you want, but you're doing it in a laboratory. So what I'm concerned about is I'm thinking we need more legislators that think like John Adams and all of our leaders to talk about what our inalienable rights are instead of what are, you know, rights by custom.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of problems here.
Stan, thank you. It's great. Great contribution to the conversation today, and a couple things there. We can talk legislatively too, because I think people on both sides of the aisle, doctor, are all pro IVF. They don't see any problem with that. The other aspect too, and he shared the story about one doctor who inseminated by his sperm over 100 women, and you know, most people you probably have dated in your local community there, and most people meet their lifelong partner maybe sometimes within a 12-mile radius. So can you imagine these kids growing up in the area and you somehow dating your sister or your brother, right? It's weird. And he's not the only one to do that. There's been others where a lot of women will go in and say, I want a guy over 6 feet. I want his IQ to be X, and I want him to be this. And sometimes guys will go in there and they lie on their profile. And women are getting sperm for those eggs that certainly are not representative of what they they hoped, much to their chagrin, a little bit later. I've got to take a break, but we'll pick it up on the other side. We'll continue our conversation. Feel free to join us, 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. If I can get that out. We are just doing a 101 today on in vitro fertilization, helping you understand the moral implications of this, because it can be confusing. So revisiting it for you. I'll be right back. Stay with me.
Connecting you to the truths of your Catholic faith. The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Thanks to network sponsor PushPay. PushPay offers parishes a platform for tracking donations and sacraments, overseeing schedules, mobile apps to help manage your administrative load, and much more. Info at relevantradio.com/pushpay. That's relevantradio.com/pushpay.
I do think that my words today are important because all too often, unfortunately, we forget the people that are the most affected by surrogacy. But these people, they never give their consent, they never have their word, and those are the children that are born from surrogacy. These children that are ripped from their mothers at birth to be sold to strangers. Kind of like cars that you order from factories, that you pick options that you may or may not like. And these children are considered just like vulgar objects and products. I am today a product of surrogacy. Created, sold, bought. And I'd like to tell you my side of the story so you can understand how it affected me and why today we can't just simply regulate surrogacy. We have to abolish it purely and simply for the good of the child and, of course, for the rights of children.
Current topics, Catholic values. You're listening to The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
That was a 32-year-old woman named Olivia Morell, and she was speaking before the Czech Parliament last October. She has an incredible story, and she's extraordinarily brave for taking on what now has become a multi-million dollar global industry using primarily poor women who are contracted by wealthy women. And this big business in India and all sorts of other places around the world, but sometimes even same-sex couples who claim to be conservatives are also having babies. There's a guy named Guy Benson. I think he's on Fox, I think. And I think he's a radio host as well, who also, you know, a lot of guys want to go down this lane to gestate babies that they either, you know, can have or don't want. A lot of gay people are now trying to have children this way. And I was watching some decorating show. There's two guys and you see their family and it looks very loving and everything is portrayed that way. But I always wonder about the child, which is the byproduct of this. You know, there's a reason why Kim Kardashian and Nicole Kidman, they hire these women to be surrogates. They don't want their bodies being impregnated, right? They don't want to interrupt their business careers. And one final note, I want to get to my guests, and you can join me today too, but I saw a story that the Department of Veteran Affairs announced that they're going to offer tax-funded in vitro fertilization and surrogacy to veterans, including those in same-sex marriages. And the IVF is really no surprise, but offering surrogacy, that's a whole another issue. If you're just joining me, Dr. Pia Desalegni joins me today. She is a senior director of corporate engagement for IWP Capital, which you can find at iwpcapital.com. She's also a moral theologian, and you can get her writings at moraltheologian.com. A lot to talk about, Doctor. We had our last call, Stan, who talked about women unknowingly getting sperm that they might be related to or not representative of what they think it is. We talked a little bit about legislation. You just heard the powerful testimony of Olivia Morell sharing her experience. Let me throw it to you. I want you to unpack because there's a lot for us to get to here.
Oh, tons. I was really grateful for Stan's call because I had not brought up, which is the people most directly involved, and that is the children. And so, again, I just think it's so important to step back and listen. And there have been so many testimonies done by children created from IVF
talking about their experiences. So they're either, they can be along the lines of something like Olivia, whose piece you had there. It can be something where they don't know that they were who their father is, who their biological father is, because they were conceived with donor sperm. And so they're actually creating, this has been going on for a long time. It didn't start happening last year. I mean, we've had decades of IVF. So now we have decades of children wanting to know who they are and going online to create data banks so that they can connect with people, siblings, family members, and so forth, because we all have a right to know who we are. And this is hard for adopted kids, too. I mean, oftentimes they don't know who their biological family was, what their story is. And it really has, it can affect someone in a very negative and difficult way, all right? And so with the children created through IVF or surrogacy, with surrogacy, there's a lot of questions that come up. And just personal identity questions, not to mention like, hey, you just like to know, you know, what is your biological makeup and, you know, where do you come from? And again, adopted children face some of these same challenges. The thing is that a lot of IVF kids are participating in these databases that they've created and it's their own communities to figure out not only where they came from, but who's my family, who's my biological family, who am I connected to? And so it's not unlike, again, what we see happening with adoption, but again, it's much more intentional in the case of IVF or surrogacy. These things are baked into it, right? With adoption, the child's already conceived and born, and so there needs to be a response. And how do you nourish that child? So we've missed that voice, and what's happened is, that, and the church has used this language consistently, it's the commodification, not just the commodification of women, of sperm donors, but also the commodification of children. We're commodifying children. And the language that the church has consistently used to talk about children as gift, right? We don't have a right to a child. The child is a gift. And those of us who have experienced infertility, we know this is a very real experience. We know that a child is a gift because it's something that we're trying for and it's not happening, right? And we've got all the parts in place. We're going through the motions and it's not happening. And we understand that it's a gift. But what we're doing is we're turning the child into some type of a property or a right. And people do have this language. They'll talk about, well, I have a right to have a child. Well, yes and no. Let's parse that a little bit. And again, we really need to talk about the implications on the child. And St. John Paul II had a beautiful line. I've never been able to source it, but I love the line. He says, every child has the right to be conceived as a result, out of love, as a result of love. So that's setting a high bar even for heterosexual relationships, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
The parents should love each other. And in the church, you know, we say that they should be in a committed, stable relationship, which is known as matrimony, and they should be married. But the parents should love each other when they bring that child into the world. And John Paul II, in his essays, Person and Community, he talks about the fact that when a couple enters the conjugal embrace, they should be saying, I could become a mother. I could become a father. And again, at the beginning of the show, you took us back to contraception, and contraception changed the very way that we think about marital intimacy.
Yep.
So we now, lots of people are quote unquote surprised to find out that they're pregnant. And I mean, our Blessed Virgin Mary she was surprised about how the angel appeared to her, right?
Mm-hmm.
But she even she knew and understood. And so it strikes me that when, you know, I understand couples that have been dealing with fertility or maybe it's a later in life pregnancy. Okay, there's an element of surprise. But by and large, this element of surprise is stunning. And to me, it's very representative of the contraceptive culture. So what we've done, just to tie this all together, is we're commodifying the child.
Yep.
And we're not, you know, to Olivia's point in that clip, the consent of the child is never taken. And we're seeing, if we listen to the voices of these children, some of them haven't expressed any displeasure, but there are a lot of them that are expressing suffering, pain, loss. And, you know, full circle to what has the church been teaching? Well, the child is a gift and that the child should be the result of love. So again, that's setting the bar high for all of us. It's saying
that when we bring a child into the world, this is how it should be done. And this is it should be a stable, permanent union expressing love.
So what's your thought? I mean, Olivia, she had to find out on her own that she was the product of surrogacy. And that, she said, caused her a lot of mental anguish. What about these children who know that, you know, their two dads are raising them, and they had a surrogate, carry the child or whatever? What's that do to the child that are in these type of relationships that don't come from the marital act, that one that is both procreative and unitive?
So again, I'm not a psychologist. I'm not a mental health expert. Just want to put that out there. Based on what I'm reading, them sharing their experiences, it causes a lot of confusion. And what do you do? I'm sure they love both of their dads, and so they're conflicted because I'm saying best case scenario, these people love each other. It's a loving family unit, not with the church mapped out, but let's just take it at face value. Gotcha. And so I think it creates a lot of conflict. And you begin to think about, well, wait a minute, but who's mom? Somebody was mom on a biological level, and it could have been, mom was an egg donor, and then there was a surrogate. So there's actually two women that on a biological level have played a role in their coming to be. It's just a lot of pain and conflict. And again, it doesn't dismiss the love that they have experienced, but it doesn't negate that, but there's an element of conflict.
I want to grab Dave in Modesto. He's been holding for a while, and I'll take all your calls at 888-914-9149. But let me just follow up on another aspect that's very quickly. It was a story that I was going to share the other day that it came across. And if you want to glimpse something that is a look at an apocalyptic future, look what scientists at the Oregon Health and Science University are doing. There was a paper published in Science Advances, and the researchers, they describe taking a mouse egg, right? They strip out its nucleus. They replace it with the nucleus from skin cells of, well, a completely different mouse, and then they fertilize it with sperm from a third mouse. And that way you end up with a mouse that has been genetic material from three different mice. Why am I sharing that? Well, the reason they're doing it, of course, is so that two men who want to say that, look, we had a baby together, yeah, this is both of our genetic material, might be able to do it. I mean, this is Frankensteinian right now. It's scary stuff. I mean, right now, other researchers are taking skin cells and reprogramming them to become either sperm or egg cells. That takes months to do. It can, of course, introduce impurities in the process. But this new process is, it's probably not going to be available for a few years, but it's coming. It is coming. What do you make of this, where you're going to have two men or two women or whatever it's going to be, whatever the mix is, share the genetic makeup of their child by tinkering with science? I think there's always consequence when you deviate from natural law, from God's moral law. And quite often there are unforeseen circumstances. Doctor, your thoughts?
Oh, I think, again, there are going to be lots of unforeseen circumstances and outcomes. I think, again, getting back to that, Adam, at the very beginning of Genesis, right, God gives him the animals to name, mm-hmm. but he can't name himself until Eve is created. And he knows himself in relation to Eve. And we know ourselves in relation to others. We have a natural desire for relationship with our biological parents. And now we're creating, again, this environment in which people may not know who they came from or, all of the people involved in this process. Undoubtedly we are headed towards an experience that will be, it's going to have consequences that we can't even begin to see now, and consequences that will be traumatic. And, I laugh because on the one hand we're pushing organic everything, and hey, I'm all for clean eating. My parents were among the original crunchy conservatives, all right? So I'm all that's the way I grew up. I totally buy into it. At the same time, we don't apply organic and some type of integrity to our own bodies, our fertility, conceiving children. It's just astounding to me. And I'm like, well, the church is kind of been saying organic,
from the human perspective, from the perspective right. of the human person. And I think we kind of have to go back to that.
Well, doctor, hold the thought. I had to take a real quick break here. When we come back, we'll pick it up. It's the final segment of the Drew Mariani Show. You can get in last chance at 888-914-9149. Give us a ring. Our conversation will continue right after this. Sponsor of the University of Dallas, the Catholic University for Independent Thinkers, invites high school juniors, seniors, and recent graduates to study the great books this summer at UD's two-week-long Arete program while earning 3 hours of college credit. Info at relevantradio.com/UDallas.
As soon as I was born, I wasn't placed in the arms of my biological mother. The mother who had carried me for 9 months, the one who fed me, the one who spoke to me, the one who I felt every emotion invade her when she was pregnant, the one who in the end was the only person I knew. No, I had to take the great leap of the infant out of my mother's womb into the cold, austere world, the hospital lights. And I had to be sold and finalize the transaction into the arms of my adoptive parents, whom I didn't know of. And that, unfortunately, was the first trauma that would write the rest of my life, the trauma of abandonment.
Life as you've never heard it. You're listening to The Drew Mariani Show.
That's another clip from the incredible testimony of Olivia Morrell. She's outlining really how the practice of surrogacy imprints really a terrible trauma in a child at birth, the trauma of abandonment. The whole process of IVF and of surrogacy is something I thought was important to talk about. And I wanted to revisit it today because we're seeing legislation, we're seeing Supreme Court decisions, we're seeing leaders all talk about in vitro. And I just wanted you to be aware of the moral consequences for this. A little bit earlier, I was struck by something that my guest, Dr. Pia De Seleni, said. She talked about the number. I saw a stat where the CDC, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, they estimate that a quarter of a million patients attempted IVF in 2021. And if clinics created between 7 and 8 embryos for every patient, just take that average, that would yield 1.5 to 2 million embryos every single year. Not even 100 of those, not even 100,000 of those 2 million are brought to term. Maggie said to me when she heard those numbers, this is a Holocaust. It's a modern day Holocaust because you're left with more than 1 million embryos. What happens to those unborn children? They get dumped. They get discarded. They get frozen. You know, that's a worse abortion record than nearly 1 million abortions that happen at clinics. More children die through IVF than do abortion annually. It's a stunning, stunning number. Doctor, it's good to have you back with me. Let's jump right into the phones. David's been waiting a long time. He's got a question for you. He's in Modesto, California. David, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. Two quick questions, but I think you just answered the second one about how many conceived eggs there are from IVF versus actually get implanted into the mother to be born and what's done with the others. My first question was that when I was younger, I was told that the pill prevented conception. And many years later, I read something that said it does not prevent conception. What it prevents is the egg from attaching to the uterine wall to go ahead and grow to full completion. And so I wasn't sure if one of those is accurate or not, or something else is the case with the pill. And you kind of answered my second question already. Thank you.
Well, David, first of all, thanks for holding so long. Doctor, I'll let you respond to him.
Sure. So I was, with regard to the embryo, a lot of the embryos that are created, they're either destroyed. And I'm guessing based on the numbers that the majority are destroyed and the minority are frozen. So again, we have over a million frozen embryos, and things can happen. People stop paying to have them frozen, the unit has a malfunction, all sorts of things can happen. So again, it is, I think the language Holocaust is right. With regard to the pill, so it's kind of a both and question. It depends on the pill itself. And I'm a PhD doctor. I'm not a medical doctor. So, but the some forms of the pill do prevent implantation. Others prevent conception. And so you'd want to do a deeper dive into that. But those that prevent implantation, so it's basically working as an abortifacient. It hardens the walls of the uterus so that the embryo cannot implant. And I just want to make sure that our that your listeners know there is an alternative to IVF and different assisted reproductive technologies, and it's called NAPRO technologies, N-A-P-R-O. And you can look them up online. They've got doctors that I think are pretty much across the United States. More and more doctors and nurses have been trained in this technology. And again, the thinking there is, how do we get, particularly a woman who's dealing with infertility, how do we get her body to healthy? And and once we do that, guess what? The, they're having, I think, again, it's over 60% of the the women are able to conceive naturally and have healthy pregnancies that come to term. So that is a tremendous resource that's out there.
Doctor, what about embryo what about embryo adoption? I know another couple who wanted to adopt somebody else's frozen embryos. That's a little bit different than surrogacy, isn't it? You're not raising it for the person. You're raising that child for your own. How does that square?
So the church hasn't come out definitively on that. There is language in the document, I think it's Dignitas Humanae, the dignity of the human person, which really makes it sound like the church is not going to go there.
Okay.
I think there are a lot of issues with it, that pastoral issues that need to be addressed. How do you explain to people that surrogacy is wrong, IVF is wrong, assisted reproductive technologies are wrong, but you can do an adoption of an embryo and then surrogacy isn't wrong. Yeah, gotcha. Then all these technologies, but there's a very human level to it as well, which is this is a baby and what a human being, not a baby, it's a human being that we want to rescue. The reality is, as far as I can tell, again, from looking at the research, many of these embryos are not even going to survive the implant being thawed out, much less the implantation process, because they've been frozen for so long. The technologies are better now than they were even 5 years ago.
That's what happened with this couple.
It's very complicated.
They lost the first implant that they had there. Rhonda's in Michigan. Let me sneak her in because we only have about 2 minutes left. Rhonda, thank you for calling. Good afternoon.
Oh, well, thank you. Very interesting conversation. And I just thought I would share, about 30 years ago, I went down the artificial insemination path. So one step away from IVF, and that was just starting. And as I became older, I mean, I resulted in a beautiful baby, but I took God out of the equation, and I wanted to share that. I took God out of the equation on that.
Well, thank you very much, Rhonda, for sharing. And it's a grace, you know, it really is. It's Pia De Seleni. Thank you for your time, doctor. I'll give you the final thoughts. I've got less than a minute.
It's always good to be on with you, Drew. I just think really we have to bring it down to the rights of the child, and no human should be commodified. And every child has that right to be conceived out of love. And there's just so much to unpack there. But I think that if we keep that as our guide, that's going to impact even what our natural marriages look like in our natural relationships. And at the end of the day, I just want to get out there again. I can't say it enough. NAPRO technologies for those who are struggling with infertility. I mean, that's cheaper, healthier, and more effective than IVF.
Yeah, well, doctor, thank you for your time. I am grateful for it. And if people want to read your writing, moraltheologian.com, is that the best place to go?
That is, yes.
All right, well,
and
sounds
I'm also
great.
At IWPcapital.com.
Thanks so much for being here. I'm out of time for the day. Your news and headlines are straight ahead. If you missed this conversation or you feel it's important for someone else to hear, go and download the podcast, okay, and share the show with others. Say a prayer for me. I'm going to be praying for you. And until we talk tomorrow, remember, God loves you. And so do I.